Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Michael Polignano. Today's podcast is devoted to three essays about Adolf Hitler in honor of his birthday on April 20th. Our first piece is William Pierce's The Measure of Greatness, which I will read. April 20th of this year is the 100th anniversary of the birth of the greatest man of our era, a man who dared more and achieved more, who set his aim higher and climbed higher, who felt more deeply and stirred the souls of those around him more mightily, who was more closely attuned to the life force which permeates our cosmos and gives it meaning and purpose, and did more to serve that life force than any other man of our times. And yet, he is the most reviled and hated man of our times. Only a few tens of thousands of men and women in scattered groups around the world will celebrate his birthday with love and reverence on April 20th, while all of the scribblers and commentators of the controlled news media, the controlled politicians, and the controlled churchmen will pour out their hatred and venom and lies against him. And those lies will be believed by hundreds of millions. What is the measure of greatness in a man? Only the most vulgar and doctrinaire Democrat would seriously equate greatness with popularity. Although, in any polling of average citizens on their choice for the greatest man of the century, there are certain to be substantial numbers of votes for Elvis Presley, John Kennedy, Billy Graham, Michael Jackson, and various other high-visibility lightweights. Charismatic entertainers on the stage of politics, rock concerts, spectator sports, or what have you. More serious citizens would pass by the lightweights and choose men who have changed the world in some way. We would hear choices like Franklin Roosevelt, Albert Einstein, and Martin Luther King, who, respectively, quote, saved the world from fascism, taught us about the nature of our universe, or helped us achieve racial justice. Depending on whether one's personal inclinations lay more in the direction of politics, science, or racial self-abasement. But if the poll asked instead for the most evil man of the century, or the most hated man, or the man having the most negative influence, at least three-quarters of the blue-collar and the white-collar pollies alike would name one man, Adolf Hitler. This, however, would be merely a reflection of the role assigned to him by the controlled mass media, rather than a truly informed and reasoned choice. All of this raises several very interesting issues. There is, for example, the question of how we came to the preposterous state of affairs prevailing today, wherein we place the destiny of our nation, our planet, and our race in the hands of a mass of voters. A mass of voters whose powers of judgment are manifested in such things as the type of television entertainment their preferences have pushed into prime time, and the type of men they have elected to public office. And there is the equally weighty question of how, knowing the ease with which this mass is misled, we permitted virtually all of the media of mass information and entertainment to fall into the hands of a race whose interests are so diametrically opposed to our own. Perhaps even more pertinent to a consideration of human greatness, however, is the question of how our system of values came to be turned on its head, so that Franklin Roosevelt is regarded as a hero and Adolf Hitler as a villain, not only by the stolid and stunned masses, but also by a majority of supposedly educated elite, many of whom pride themselves on their intellectual independence. Whether we judge the greatness of a man by his intrinsic qualities of character and soul or by his accomplishments, Adolf Hitler had greatness of a very high order, if we use the standards which have been traditional in our race. We cannot, of course, make comparisons with all the mute, inglorious Miltons, whose lack of notable accomplishment has made them anonymous, despite the sterling inner qualities they may have possessed. But when Hitler's character is held up beside those of other 20th century political leaders, he stands as a giant among pygmies. At the prosaic level, we can note his ascetic personal habits compared with Winston Churchill's habitual drunkenness and notorious self-indulgence, or his personal loyalty to those who had been his comrades in the days of political struggle, compared with Joseph Stalin's habit of murdering his former comrades by the dozen as potential rivals as soon as he no longer needed their services. or his direct, frank, and straightforward manner, compared to the cunning deviousness which was Franklin Roosevelt's trademark. At the spiritual level, the inner differences between Hitler and his contemporaries are even more striking. Hitler was a man with a mission, from the beginning. The testimony of his closest associates, from his boyhood days to the end of his life, agrees with the observations of more distant and impartial observers. Hitler had a mystical sense of destiny, a sense of having been singled out and called by a higher power to devote his life to the service of his race. His childhood companion, August Kubicek, has related extraordinary evidence of this when Hitler was only 16 years old. 20 years later, while he was in prison after an unsuccessful attempt to overthrow the government, Hitler himself wrote of his motivation in a way which suggested the range of his vision. Quote, "What we must fight for is the security of the existence and reproduction of our race and our people, the sustenance of our children, and the maintenance of the purity of our blood, so that our people may mature for the fulfillment of the mission allotted to them by the Creator of the universe. Every thought and every idea, every doctrine and all knowledge must serve this purpose, and everything must be examined from this point of view and used or rejected according to its utility. Then no theory will stiffen into a dead doctrine, since it is life alone that all things must serve." The National Socialist philosophy finds the importance of mankind in its basic racial elements. On principle, in the state, it sees a means to an end, and construes that end as the preservation of the racial existence of man. And so the National Socialist philosophy of life corresponds to the innermost will of nature, since it restores that free play of forces which must lead to a continuous mutual higher breeding, until finally the best of humanity, having achieved possession of this earth, will have a free play for activity in domains which lie partly above it and partly outside of it. We all sense that in the distant future humanity must be faced by problems which only a highest race, become master people and supported by the means and possibilities of an entire globe, will be equipped to overcome. Thus, the highest purpose of a National Socialist state is concerned for the preservation of those original racial elements which bestow culture and create the beauty and dignity of a higher mankind. We, as Aryans, can conceive of the state only as the living organism of a nationality, which not only assures the preservation of this nationality, but by the development of its spiritual and ideal abilities leads it to the highest freedom. A National Socialist state must begin by raising marriage from the level of a continuous defilement of the race and give it the consecration of an institution which is called upon to produce images of the Lord and not monstrosities halfway between man and ape. It must set race in the center of all life. It must take care to keep it pure. It must declare the child to be the most precious treasure of the people. It must see to it that only the healthy beget children. The National Socialist state must make certain that by a suitable education of youth, it will someday obtain a race ripe for the last and greatest decisions on this earth. Anyone who wants to cure this era, which is inwardly sick and rotten, must first summon the courage to make clear the causes of this disease. And this should be the concern of the National Socialist movement, pushing aside all narrow-mindedness, to gather and to organize from the ranks of our nation those forces capable of becoming the vanguard fighters for a new philosophy of life. We are not simple enough to believe that it could ever be possible to bring about a perfect era, but this relieves no one of the obligation to combat recognized errors, to overcome weaknesses, and to strive for the ideal. Harsh reality of its own accord will create only too many limitations. For that very reason, however, man must try to serve the ultimate goal, and failures must not deter him, any more than he can abandon a system of justice because mistakes creep into it, or any more than medicine is discarded because there will always be sickness in spite of it. We National Socialists know that with this conception we stand as revolutionaries in the world of today and are branded as such. But our thoughts and actions must in no way be determined by the approval or disapproval of our time, but by the binding obligation to a truth which we have recognized. Unquote. Hitler's opponents, Churchill and Roosevelt, were party politicians, with the minds and souls of party politicians. Great impersonal goals, just as truth, meant nothing at all to them. The only thing that counted was the approval or disapproval of their times, the outcome of the next election, a good press clack, votes. Only Stalin, in any way, shared Hitler's disdain for approval. Only Stalin was motivated to any degree by an impersonal idea. But the idea that Stalin served was the alien, destructive idea of Jewish Marxism. And while Hitler served the life force with the instincts of a seer, Stalin served Marxism with the instincts of a bureaucrat and a butcher. A comparison of careers leads us to a similar ranking of greatness of soul. Churchill and Roosevelt were born into the political establishment. They fed at the public trough for years, in one office after another, grabbing greedily at opportunities for a bigger serving of swill. But it was circumstance, not their own efforts, which thrust them onto the stage of world history. Stalin hacked out his own niche in history to a much greater extent than his Western allies, and he was an incomparably stronger man than either of them. He was tough, ruthless, infinitely cunning, and utterly determined to prevail, no matter what the obstacles. Even so, his struggle for prominence and power was entirely within the Bolshevik Party and its predecessors. He was the consummate bureaucratic infighter, not the innovator or the lone pioneer. Only Adolf Hitler started literally from nothing, and through the exercise of a superhuman will, created the physical basis for the realization of his vision. In 1918, recovering in a veterans' hospital from a British poison gas attack, he made the decision to enter politics in order to serve that vision. He was a 29-year-old invalid, with no money, no family, no friends or connections, no university education, and no experience. Liberals, Jews, and communists ruled his country, making him and all those to whom he might appeal for support outsiders. 5.5 years later, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison for his political activity, and his enemies thought that was the end of him and his movement. But less than 9 years after being sentenced, he was Chancellor of Germany, with the strongest and most progressive nation in Europe at his command. He had built the National Socialist Movement and led it to victory over the organized opposition of the entire establishment, conservatives, liberals, communists, Jews, and Christians. He then transformed Germany, lifting it out of its economic depression, while Americans under Roosevelt continued to line up at the soup kitchens. He restored its spirit and much of the territory which had been taken from it by the victors of the First World War. He stimulated its artistic and scientific creativity and won the admiration, or in some cases the envy and hatred, of other nations. It was an achievement hardly paralleled in the history of the world. Even those who do not understand the real significance of his creation must concede that. And what was the real significance of Hitler's work? One of his most earnest admirers in India, Savitri Devi, has given us a poetic answer to that question. She wrote, quote, "In its essence, the National Socialist idea exceeds not only Germany in our times, but the Aryan race and mankind itself and any epoch. It ultimately expresses that mysterious and unfailing wisdom according to which nature lives and creates, the impersonal wisdom of the primeval forest and of the ocean depth and of the spheres and the dark fields of space." It is Adolf Hitler's glory not merely to have gone back to that divine wisdom, stigmatizing man's silly infatuation for quote-unquote intellect, his childish pride in quote-unquote progress, and his criminal attempt to enslave nature, but to have made it the basis of a practical regeneration policy of worldwide scope. Precisely now, in our overcrowded, over-civilized, and technically over-evolved world at the very end of the Dark Age. Unquote. More prosaically, Hitler's work, in contrast to that of his contemporaries, was above politics, above economics, and even above nationalism. He had mobilized a powerful modern state and placed it at the service of our race, so that our race might become fit to serve as an agent of the life force. Perceptive and idealistic young men from every nation in Europe, and from many nations outside Europe as well, recognized the significance, and they flocked to serve him and to fight for his cause, even at the cost of censure and ostracism from their more parochial and narrow-minded countrymen. There was never before an elite fighting force to match the SS, which, by the end of the war, had more non-Germans in it than Germans. The war, of course, is counted as Hitler's great failure, even as the proof of his lack of greatness by his detractors. But the war merely proves that he was a man, not a god, even if a divine will worked through him. He could not perform miracles. He could not defend himself forever with the governments of nearly the whole world allied in a total war to pull him down and destroy his creation, so that they and the interests they served could return to business as usual. Even so, he gave a far better account of himself than any of his adversaries. And what will count in the long run in determining Adolf Hitler's stature is not whether he lost or won the war, but whether it was he or his adversaries who were on the side of the life force, whether it was he or they who served the cause of truth and human progress. We only have to look around us today to know it was not they. William Pierce's The Measure of Greatness was first published as an unsigned editorial in National Vanguard magazine, April 1989.
Our first music break is an untitled work by Der Blutarsch. This is track number 9 from the CD Der Sieg des Lichtes ist des Lebens Heil, first published in 1998.
Our next segment is Countercurrents editor Greg Johnson reading his essay, The Burden of Hitler.
Adolf Hitler was born April 20th, 1889. Every April 20th, white nationalist websites inevitably see an increase in discussion and debate about Hitler and his legacy. Positions usually array themselves between two poles: Hitler is the problem, and Hitler is a solution. The claim that Hitler is the problem is basically a rejection of a burden of guilt by association. Hitler is the most hated man in our whole Judaized culture. Indeed, hating Hitler is the only moral judgment not stigmatized by modern moral relativists. The only absolute moral standard we are allowed is Hitler as the incarnation of evil, and all lesser evils are evil by being like Hitler, which ultimately means that all white people are evil due to our kinship to Hitler. The blame Hitler argument boils down to this: if only Adolf Hitler had not started World War II, killed 6 million Jews, and tried to conquer the world, white nationalism would get good press and perhaps make some progress in the political realm. Hitler is the reason why race realism, eugenics, immigration control, and nationalism have been discredited in the eyes of whites the world over. Thus, if white nationalism is to have any chance of changing the world, we need to ritually condemn and repudiate Hitler and everything he stood for, as well as all of his present-day followers. I find this argument to be morally contemptible and politically naive. It is contemptible because it essentially boils down to an attempt to curry favor with our enemies and to pander to ignoramuses and fools by throwing a loyal white man under the bus. And make no mistake, Adolf Hitler, whatever his faults, was a loyal white man who fought and died not just for Germany, but for our race as a whole. Blaming Hitler is also morally obscene because it absolves a whole host of villains who are the real architects of our race's doom: the slave traders and plantation owners who introduced blacks into the Americas, the railroad magnates and other plutocrats who brought Orientals to our shores, the traitorous capitalists who are destroying the white working and middle classes by importing non-white labor, both legal and illegal, and shipping American jobs to the Third World, the egalitarians who have not hesitated to spill oceans of white blood to promote the moral and political equality of non-whites, and of course every politician who has done the bidding of all of the above. Blame must also be placed on the organized Jewish community, which has used its control over the entertainment and news media, academia, and the professions, as well as its vast wealth, to corrupt all aspects of American politics, business, and culture, and to engineer and promote multiculturalism, mass non-white immigration, miscegenation, racial integration, and a poisonous culture of white self-hatred and non-white truculence. Blaming Hitler is also politically naive. Our race was not set on the path to destruction when Hitler was elected Chancellor of Germany in 1933. The problem started long before then, but the real turning point began in the 1880s with the immigration of millions of Jews from Eastern Europe into the United States, a country that was simply not culturally or politically capable of understanding and containing the threat they posed. By 1917, the organized Jewish community, operating through a cabal around Woodrow Wilson, had sufficient power to bring the United States into the First World War as a quid pro quo for the British Empire's Balfour Declaration, which paved the way for the foundation of the State of Israel. When Jews arrived in America en masse, they found a largely innocent and trusting people and only the weakest barriers to their rise to wealth and power. And what gratitude did the Jewish community feel toward America and its people? As soon as they were able, they traded the lives of 116,000 of the sons of those trusting Americans, plus the suffering of 205,000 more young men who were wounded, some of them unspeakably, plus the mental anguish suffered by 10 million soldiers and their loved ones, plus the years robbed from the lives of those 10 million soldiers and all those who worked to support them. plus the untold millions of Europeans who suffered and died because America's entrance prolonged the war, all in order to gain a British promise to allow Jews to displace Arabs and found a Jewish state. This was a pivotal moment in world history. In the United States, it became clear that whites had lost control of our destiny to Jews, and ever since then, Jews have been able to use their hegemony in the United States to take control of the destinies of white nations around the world and to turn more and more of them onto the path to extinction. No, their control is not absolute. In 1924, white Americans passed immigration restriction. However, by 1941, Jews and their allies had delivered America into another world war. In the 1950s and 60s, they spearheaded, funded, and controlled the civil rights movement. And by 1965, after more than 40 years of lobbying, Jews were pivotal in opening America's borders to non-white immigration. If Hitler had never been elected Chancellor of Germany, if the Second World War had never happened, Jews would still have lobbied for open borders. They would still have promoted multiculturalism, feminism, and generalized cultural decadence. They would still have promoted pseudoscientific race denial, racial egalitarianism, and racial integration. They would still have corrupted our political system to pursue Jewish interests at the expense of American interests. How do I know this? Because they were already doing all these things long before Hitler came to power. Jews are promoting conditions that are leading to the genocide of the white race. They are not doing this out of self-defense against Hitler's aggression, since they were doing it even when Hitler was just a common soldier in the Great War. Indeed, the truth is that Hitler did whatever he did in self-defense against Jewish aggression, the same Jewish aggression that we are suffering today in a much intensified form. The blame Hitler argument also commits what I like to call the one little thing fallacy. The way some people talk, Adolf Hitler is the one little thing standing in the way of our victory. If only he had remained a painter, we would be living in a white republic today. But history is not that simple. History is a net result of billions of causal factors interacting with one another. Therefore, chances are, one little thing is never responsible for any large-scale historical phenomenon, whether good or bad. A choice example of the one little thing fallacy is a spurious quote attributed to Benjamin Franklin that floats around right-wing circles. According to this legend, Franklin claimed that America needed to exclude Jews from the very beginning, else that one little thing will undo our otherwise perfect culture and political system. This kind of thinking is appealing because it simplifies matters considerably and spares us from the necessity of reflecting on broader, deeper, systematic problems that might implicate us as well. Blaming Hitler is just another form of blaming ourselves for our ongoing racial decline. It deflects attention from the real culprits, the white traitors and aliens, and replaces righteous anger at our enemies with demoralizing self-reproach and self-doubt. Anger motivates action. Self-reproach promotes passivity. So our march to oblivion continues uninterrupted. White nationalists who feel like Hitler is a burden on our cause need to recognize that ritually condemning him on his birthday does no good. Hitler is dead and he cannot be harmed, and they are still goyim slated for extinction. The only thing that has changed is their own moral status. They may have won the esteem of knaves and fools, but better men see them as ignorant and vile. What good is the friendship of the corrupt and cowardly if it costs you the friendship of the honorable and upright? How then can one lessen the burden of Hitler, the Hitler of anti-white propaganda? If a person damages your car, cursing him might feel good, but the only way to fix things is to get some sort of compensation. How can Hitler compensate us for the burden of Hitler? All he has to offer us today is knowledge. So if we can learn something from Hitler that actually helps our race, that would at least contribute to lessening or lifting the burden of Hitler. If you believe that Hitler is keeping the white race down, then pick Hitler up. Read Mein Kampf. Hitler's table talk, and so forth, and see if you can glean some useful truths. And there is a lot of truth there about race, history, the Jewish question, political philosophy, economics, culture, religion, and the dead ends of bourgeois liberalism and conservatism. Mein Kampf is filled with practical advice about radical political organizing and propaganda that remains valid to this day. Hitler was right about another thing as well. Quote, "The National Socialist doctrine, as I have always proclaimed, is not for export. It was conceived for the German people." What he means is that the ideas behind National Socialism may be universally and eternally true, but the National Socialist movement, its political platforms, symbolism, and other external trappings, are the products of a particular place and time. Thus, people who dress up like stormtroopers in 21st century America have only a superficial understanding of Hitler's teachings. A real follower of the leader would look as American as apple pie. You might also pick up a few good books about Hitler and the Second World War, just so that you do not fall into the trap of discussing them in terms of preposterous war propaganda, like Hitler started the Second World War and Hitler was out to conquer the world. Begin with Patrick Buchanan's Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. I would also look at A.J. P. Taylor's The Origins of the Second World War. And be sure to read David Irving's enthralling and fact-packed books, The Warpath and Hitler's War, which are now available in a single volume. Lesser researchers routinely plunder them, so you might as well go back to the source. I do not think that the progress of white nationalism in the 21st century requires the rehabilitation of Hitler and the Third Reich, which in any case would be an infinite task for scholars and a distraction for political activists. But when historical clichés are regularly lobbed at us like grenades, every responsible adult needs the basic knowledge necessary to defuse them. We don't need to be learned doctors of revisionism, but we should be able to apply some battlefield first aid. Perhaps the most subversive thing one can do regarding Adolf Hitler is simply to ignore those who hate him or love him blindly, and instead discuss him rationally and objectively like any other historical figure. If you follow this advice, I guarantee that the burden of Hitler will begin to slowly fade. But you may also discover that the burden of thinking that Hitler was wrong is nothing compared to the burden of believing that Hitler was right.
Greg Johnson's The Burden of Hitler was first published on April 20th, 2011 at countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.
Our second music break is another untitled track by Der Bluthirsch. This is track number 10 from Der Sieg des Lichtes ist des Lebens Heil.
I'm concerned.
Our final piece is my reading of Erman Vinson's Some Thoughts on Hitler, the title essay of the new anthology of Vinson's writings published by Countercurrents. Hitler as Multiracialist Propaganda. The argument advanced by some racial nationalists that any defense of Adolf Hitler, in light of the hostility and even revulsion that his name now evokes, risks alienating mainstream whites is plausible on its surface and should receive a respectful hearing, but it is still on the balance mistaken. Although most nationalists in the United States and even in Germany do not consider themselves national socialists, multiracialists and anti-white Jewish advocacy groups call each and every one of us a Nazi. It is an undeniable fact that in our contemporary political climate, any white nationalism, as recent events in the Balkans amply demonstrate, will be labeled Hitlerian and will summon, in breathless media presentations, quote, the specter of the Holocaust, unquote, and anguished fears that, quote, it, unquote, might just happen again if the Goyim get too restless. That, after all, is the central lesson taught by the countless Holocaust museums sprouting up like noxious toadstools throughout most of the West, that white racial consciousness is literally lethal and must therefore be actively combated, a lesson which we have now enshrined in deference to Jewry at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, a national memorial to our white wickedness. We are thus obliged, like it or not, to live under Hitler's shadow. Our enemies have ensured that any expression of white racial consciousness, however innocuous, will be officially pronounced hatefully Hitlerian and Nazi, whether we admire Hitler or despise him. It is therefore incumbent on us, as a simple matter of self-defense, to arrive at a balanced view of Hitler and the movement he founded. Anyone who doubts all of this should recall the abuse that Pat Buchanan received at the hands of the controlled media and the organized Jewish community during his campaigns for the Republican nomination. Buchanan is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a national socialist, nor even a conscious racialist. He is, instead, a traditional Christian conservative, with all of the virtues and liabilities that entails. But he was persistently labeled a Nazi nevertheless. Liberal columnist Molly Ivins opined that his 1992 speech at the Republican National Convention, quote, probably sounded better in the original German. Her meaning was clear. She was identifying Buchanan as a Nazi, delegitimizing his nationalism and social conservatism with the most potent weapon in the left's rhetorical arsenal. So as racial nationalists, we can either manufacture false anti-racist credentials by claiming to hate Hitler just as much as Abe Foxman does, a subterfuge that I very much doubt will convince anyone, least of all Abe, or we can tell the truth. The truth is that the maniacal Hitler of popular demonology is a World War II propaganda fiction. The principal purpose of the fiction's incessant repetition more than 50 years after the war is to stigmatize any nationalist movement, NS or otherwise. Hitler now represents not a specific historical figure in the political party he led, but nationalism of any variety, from timid anti-immigration conservatives to angry white power skinheads. The system's anti-Hitler orthodoxy, invoked almost daily, is in effect tacit propaganda for multiracialism and a potent device to keep all nationalists perpetually hiding in closets, too afraid of labels like racist and Nazi to openly say what we sincerely believe. We have, therefore, a real interest in demythologizing Hitler, and we have no hope of escaping our association with what he now represents. We can't run away from Hitler, regardless of how much some of us would like to. Let's notice the obvious. The crucial facts about World War II are uncomplicated and readily available in mainstream sources. NS Germany had limited war aims: the recovery of territory taken from Germany at Versailles, the acquisition of living space for the German people in the East, and the destruction of the Marxist Soviet Union, history's most brutal regime. Insofar as the United States had any stake at all in the outcome of the war, it would have been to help Germany and her Axis allies, including thousands of Russian patriots, accomplish the latter. absent the campaign conducted by the Western democracies to save Stalinism by defeating Hitler, the Soviet Union would have collapsed. Since America had no national interests in the conflict in Europe, our government deliberately lied about German war aims in order to manufacture the perception that we did, claiming that Hitler had global territorial ambitions, a plan for, quote, world domination, unquote. Over 50 years later, most Americans still accept the lies. The predictable result of the Allied victory and the German defeat was Stalin's occupation of half of Europe. A war that ostensibly began to restore Polish sovereignty ended with Poland, along with the rest of Eastern Europe, being handed over to the communists. And in quite clear terms, no American would have died in Vietnam if Hitler had destroyed Soviet communism, which was arguably the central objective of his political career. American soldiers fought in Europe so that their sons could die in Southeast Asia. None of this should be the least controversial. It is a symptom of the effect of persistent propaganda that so many of us fail to notice the obvious. It is only a slight exaggeration to say that multiracialism itself, along with our servile deference to Jewry, is founded on the mythical image of Hitler as evil incarnate, Satan's secular counterpart in modern history. Remove the false, childishly simplistic Hitler myth, and a significant ideological justification for multiracialism would collapse. The simple question, were Hitler and NS Germany really as evil as everyone says? That question, therefore, has huge repercussions, and an entire machinery of propaganda, ranging from Hollywood films and, quote, Holocaust education in the public schools to offhand comments in the controlled media, better in the original German, has been designed to discourage anyone from even contemplating the obvious but heretical answer. National Socialism. Hitler defined his own National Socialism as a uniquely German movement. Quote, the National Socialist doctrine, as I have always proclaimed, is not for export. It was conceived for the German people. In other words, German National Socialism arose at a specific time in a specific place under the pressure of a unique set of historical circumstances, none of which could ever be precisely replicated elsewhere. In particular, the autocratic Führer state, central to NS Germany, would never be acceptable to Americans. Our Republican political culture and belief in individual rights are, thankfully, far too strong. Hitler was a dictator and his government authoritarian, which doesn't mean that NS Germany was a police state. It had, in fact, fewer policemen per capita and far fewer secret police than either modern Germany or the United States, despite the misleading image most of us have of legions of sinister Gestapo agents kicking down doors in the middle of the night. The basic principles of National Socialism are, nevertheless, universal. That God or nature has assigned each of us to a racial group and has endowed each group with distinct qualities. That a nation is not simply a geographical concept, a set of lines arbitrarily drawn on a map irrespective of the people living within them, but instead derives, or should derive, its political institutions and national objectives from the character of the people themselves. That a nation organized to preserve a race and develop its distinctive character is therefore natural. That the strength and social cohesion of a nation derives from its sense of a common identity, of which race is the most important determinant. That in addition to our individual rights, we have larger social obligations, not only to the present generation of our nation, but to its past and future generations as well. That the primary purpose of a nation is not economic, but the preservation and advancement of its people, economics being subordinate to the volkish, racial, national objectives that should be a nation's core reason for existing. The nation-state in itself, Hitler wrote, has nothing whatsoever to do with any definite economic concept or definite economic development. It does not arise from a compact made between contracting parties within a certain delimited territory for the purpose of serving economic ends. The state is a community of living beings who have kindred physical and spiritual natures, organized for the purpose of assuring the conservation of their own kind, and to help towards fulfilling those ends which Providence has assigned to that particular race or racial branch. End quote. In the generic sense of the term, National Socialism is arguably not inconsistent with democratic institutions, despite Hitler's own view of the matter. Its true antonyms are multiracialism and capitalist one-world globalism. Nor is National Socialism inconsistent with an American melting pot view of ethnicity, provided that the various ethnic groups that comprise the nation are sufficiently similar that each can see a common identity and a common destiny in the others. That is, insofar as they, despite their ethnic differences, are branches of the same race, and can, therefore, be effectively acculturated to a common set of national ideals. I consider Hitler less a model to be followed than an avalanche of propaganda we must dig ourselves out from under. Never in human history has a single man received such sustained vilification, and the basic effect and purpose of this vilification has been to inhibit whites from thinking racially and from acting in their own racial self-interest, as all other racial and ethnic groups do. Learning the truth about Hitler is a liberating experience. By the truth, I mean not an idealized counter-myth to the pervasive myth of Hitler as evil incarnate, but the man himself. Faults and virtues, strengths and weaknesses. Once you've done it, once you've discovered the real Hitler, beneath the lies and distortions that have buried his legacy, you'll be permanently immunized against anti-white propaganda, because you will have seen through the best and the worst that the system has to offer. Erman Vincent's Some Thoughts on Hitler was originally circulated on the Stormfront listserv in 1999. His anthology, Some Thoughts on Hitler and Other Essays, is available from countercurrents.com. Counter-currents.com. Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.